Poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today we speak with Canberra poet Natalie Cook, who wrestles with bees figuratively. Her work is quietly rich in sound, image, joy, and play, plus the rhyming bugle, poetry news and events from the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Natalie Cook is a Canberra-based writer interested in people and landscapes. Her first poetry collection, Wrestling with Bees, Life Before Man, Gazebo Books, appeared in 2022. In 2020, an Anne Edgeworth Fellowship enabled Natalie Cook to work with Melinda Smith to develop her manuscript for Wrestling with Bees. I asked her about the singing opening of Wrestling with Bees. It celebrates noisy friar birds.
This book starts so unusually. It starts with a song, kind of.
Yeah.
A poetic song. I wondered if you'd just talk about it a little bit.
I wrote it while I was doing a bush retreat for eco-writers out near Boorowa. So the Barbara in the poem is Barbara Holloway, whose property I was staying on. And I'd go for a walk every day and just listen to this absolute cacophony of noisy friar birds. And true to form, the way I do, I then kind of looked up noisy friar birds and had a, you know, read about them and then started thinking about their songs and the patterns of their songs and, you know, how they're represented in words. And actually sort of then used those patterns of almost like speech patterns, like sound patterns, mm-hmm. to set some text to it. And so that's why it's ended up in this form of a song, and with trying to kind of express some of that cacophony by sort of, it's very difficult to explain, but there's a chorus to it which is almost designed to be read with all four lines, like a soprano, alto, tenor and bass, all rushing through at the same time. And that's trying to reflect that madness of all these noisy friar birds in these gum trees just shouting at each other while they're eating lerps and having a fine old time.
The poem is really designed for multiple, simultaneous human voices, but Natalie read it to provide a sense of it.
Frybird anthem for Barbara. Solo, recit. Joyful. All is joyful. The gums bloom. Bugs, bugs, flittery bugs. Now it's autumn. Fill your belly. All are welcome here. Make the most of the lerps while they're sweet. Chorus, repeat until full. Tell your friends, gums in bloom. Tell your friends, gums in bloom. Winter's coming, eat your fill. Winter's coming, enough for all. Tempus fugit, tempus fugit, tempus fugit. Eat up, eat up, eat up, eat up. Reprise. Make the most of it all while you're here.
It would be amazing. I mean, I can hear it.
Yeah, I think you know, a good couple of shouty people. In the bush. I saw a couple of them in the backyard yesterday and was thinking about this.
Hmm.
This kind of, you know, intensity of enthusiasm.
Writing about the natural world definitely is one of your
focuses.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely seems a comfortable place for you. And I wonder how that's come about or...
Yeah. So I observe a lot as I kind of move through Canberra. It's a wonderful place, as you know, as somebody who also writes a lot about birds.
Yeah.
Here, you know, you can't help but see the birds as they kind of intersect with us and our gardens and our yards. More generally, I suppose, I'm the daughter of a biologist. I grew up kind of going on field trips with Dad and things like that. So, and observing that kind of thing, but not being a scientist, I'm sort of, again, on the edge of that sort of scientific world, a bit like I'm on the edge of sort of looking at the natural world. So sort of just being placed on the edge with a kind of toe of interest in there, but not fully in there, I think, is sort of where I see myself and sort of where some of what I write about and what I talk about comes from. Having an interest but not a depth of knowledge, and that can be an interesting place to be, I think.
I think that's the perfect place for a poet. because you have enough knowledge to pull you in, give you context, mm-hmm. help you understand. But at the same time, you won't over-intellectualize.
And you know you don't know so many things. And so some of the fun is in finding out more, and then as you learn, kind of trying to express that in words. And some of that is just about knowing that you're just dipping, you know, skimming along the surface. And
yeah.
And that can be kind of interesting because it lets you think about a lot of things in a little bit of depth, perhaps rather than doing a deep dive into one thing and knowing everything about, I don't know, the habits of the Firebird.
Right. And it also, I think the poetic form allows you to explore it, as you're saying, in language, but also in form. Right. So then it's the articulation, but then it's also arranging the articulation that adds yet an extra layer of understanding. Mm. And your poetry really does play with form.
Yeah, I like playing with form. I like thinking about form because sometimes, and again, it comes down to that idea that there's so much to know, so much to think about that having, I don't know, a limit of some sort of poetic form actually helps you to crystallize ideas. So, you know, it's purely self-imposed, but once I've got a form that I want to use, it really does help me edit and just keep editing down.
Right. Your book is called Wrestling with Bees. And that sometimes that's how I feel when I'm writing, right, is that I'm wrestling with language to articulate whatever subject or idea on the subject that I have.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. It's about the, you know, sort of struggling to put lots of things into a very short space, you know, number of words.
Mm.
Yeah.
I noticed one of the poems in the book is based on Mary Shelley and her lines. And I bring it up now because it's a pantoum.
Yes.
And yet, even though it's a pantoum, it goes across the gutter, across the whole page. And that's quite unusual. So you've got a form, but you're also expanding it a little.
Yeah. And that was one of the great things about working with Phil Day, the editor of Life Before Man, who is a visual artist, actually helps you to think about some of the potential. Having what's normally a fairly structured way of thinking about a page, and in fact he normally, the way Life Before Man books work is they're usually only published on one side of the page.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. you know, you open up a double fold and you've only got the poem on one side. But then that gives you tremendous potential to play with, you know, a double spread when you want to. And so that was terrific working with him and what we could do there to have some of those really quite long lines of that poem and actually go right across the gutter.
And it comes from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
Yeah, all the text is taken from there. I was working on that actually in Jervis Bay, I think when the sort of post-bushfires in sort of 2020. Yeah, and so thinking a lot about fires and about us and the environment, and I'd been rereading Frankenstein and thought some of this text is amazing and what I might be able to do with it. And then using that form of a pantoum where you iterate and iterate and iterate, and, you know, I'm not sure that the traditional Malay form does this, but certainly in English there's a tradition of playing just a little bit with some of those lines as they're repeated, but using sort of slightly different text of Shelley's each time to sort of build a bit of a picture. Summer Pantoum, all text taken from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. You throw a torch into a pile of buildings, and when they're consumed, you sit amongst the ruins and lament the fall. The bare trees and the black earth, the spark so negligently bestowed. You sit amongst the ruins and lament the fall. Selfishness had not hesitated at the price of the existence of the whole human race, the spark so negligently bestowed. But I perceive your thoughts. You do not credit my narrative. Selfishness had not hesitated at the price, the flames licked with their forked and destroying tongues. But I perceive your thoughts. You do not credit this strange and terrific story. The light of that conflagration will fade away. The flames clung and licked with their forked and destroying tongues, a kind of calm forgetfulness of which the human mind is particularly susceptible. The light of that conflagration will fade away. You throw a torch into a pile of buildings.
It's incredible, actually, to hear you say that you wrote this just following that bushfire season, because suddenly that adds yet another layer of understanding to the poem. I think it's incredible you have this very famous, important novel where ostensibly one man is building another human being piece by piece, and you're doing this line by line. And I really loved that idea.
Thank you. Yeah, and, you know, he's building something, and perhaps he's just not thinking about all the consequences of what he's doing.
The idea, too, of the using the narrative voice. You know, it is different than your own.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, that you still have to make choices, and it's pretty neat.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a very messy process writing this poem. Like, literally, physically, I went through the text. I found lines that I thought were interesting, that resonated, that sort of said something, and then printed them out, cut them up, and did it as quite a physical sort of moving around, cut and paste job. And I found that was almost the only way I could do it. You know, with the pantoum, with its reasonably complex repeating lines, you know, you sort of have to think, well, if I move line 8, it's got to move, you know,
yeah,
equivalent line further down. And so physically doing that was the way my brain had to tackle it.
Physical space,
yeah, which I think is something perhaps poets don't always talk about or think about or use, or maybe they do and they don't talk about the fact they do it. But I literally, you know, it was something that I remember learning in a workshop years ago, of, you know, the idea of actually cutting up your poems and rearranging them. And there's something wonderful about doing that in hard copy, that just lets your brain do all sorts of things that is much harder when you're cutting and pasting on a screen.
There's something, I think, about the tactility of doing something like that engages you with the language, with the images, with the words, in a way that the flat screen does not permit.
Yeah, and just the ease of being able to move things around and seeing it in a slightly different form, you know, or taking the first verse and picking it up and moving it to the end and seeing what that does, deciding you don't like it and moving it back again.
It's like using the whole page. It's like crossing the gutter,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
It seems to me that in your poems, a lot of it has to do with perspective, right? And that when you're doing that, that's what you're playing with, and you're using physical space for that. But it also seems to me that your poems are about that, right? About gaining perspective, figuring things out multiply.
Yeah, I think that's right, and sometimes questioning the perspective that we want to take on things. Perhaps a good example is, I've got a poem about a pepper tree, which is a, you know, it's an introduced species. It's a species that would be really familiar to lots of people. Lots of people grew up with it in their schoolyards or in their backyard, and they're really beautiful trees, and they're really fragrant, but they're introduced, and perhaps they've replaced other trees that could have played an interesting, you know, an important role in the ecosystem. And so just trying to sort of think about, not take things for granted, I suppose. This one's called Old Friend. I see you as you are, pepper tree. I see you, round belly wise, your leaves lace lovely, a fragrant time slip. Peeking birds, net curtain secure, beetles on your chilly chocolate bark, insects dancing due attendance, and roos heavy-eyed in redolent shade. I don't see the tree that didn't grow, or the absent birds who see nothing there for them.
On the next page of the book, you have another poem called Distance. This poem also, for me, is about perspective. And I think it's very interesting the way the poem is shaped.
Yeah, it's almost a diamond shape. So the lines get longer and longer towards the middle of the poem and then sort of fade away to a very short last line again.
You glance at the poem and it appears balanced. And yet, and then the title is Distance, right? So there's this idea of space and shape.
Distance. When wires and engines rewrote the laws of physics, stamps observed, collapsing space to find by feet and horses. The intent was to draw us closer. We learnt cleave cuts both ways. But perspective is not Euclidean. Vanishing points inspire. Parallel lines can meet. People I've mislaid in time and space may be closer than they appear. Beguiled by pixel lullabies, screens approximating proximity, I regret I let the threads linking us together come untethered. With the web itself my Ariadne, is it distance or shame that now stays me? We navigate a lot now through cyberspace, I suppose. Again, that comes back to that word of perspective, you know, how we think people are close because they're on their screens, but maybe we don't know much about what's actually happening. Or conversely, we're not in touch with them, so we think they're a long way away.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Even though they may be close by.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those lines for me represent exactly what it is that I'm sensing in your poems, right? This idea that how we perceive or understand things may be accurate, but may not be.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that some poems come together quite quickly and others take a long time?
Some are certainly much faster, and others take a very long time.
Mm.
And again, it's often that discovering that, in fact, what I've thought was an idea that was sufficient in itself wasn't, and it's actually several different things that I've been thinking of separately need to come together in one poem.
So it's a matter of facilitating that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working out, why they're actually linked thoughts, apart from the fact they're all just in my brain.
Right.
Another feature of Natalie Cook's verse is that sounds echo through her lines. Rhymes, assonances, other sonic devices. This is particularly evident and fitting in the Ensigns.
Ensigns. Canberra, Spring 2020. After Gerald Manley Hopkins. Glory be to trees for dappled shade. Fluttering shadows and flickering light. Leap across leaf mould. Skip along shrubs. A lattice of light. A scaffold for growth. Trees become humus. Hollows. Nests. Trees write the parable of the leaves and the fishes. But armies of spent matchsticks this year march across hills, burnt trunks cast but the spindliest shadows, as green ensigns emerge and semaphore their loss. New leaves form in ground-level swarms or swirl in cirrus around black stippled trunks. I'm not one for signs, not for me the substantiations of superstition or astrology's teleology, but in this year mediated by windows, on a trip just to see a horizon again, I stop the car and reach out to touch like a talisman, a leaf bud burgeoning burgundy, then green, growing steadily upwards towards the too bright sun.
You get to the end and I'm just enjoying the sounds. And then you realize the end is this idea that after months of these dark skies, you're just paying tribute to the sky that you can see because it's cleared.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was, this is a kind of mostly a bushfire poem, but it's a little bit of a pandemic poem as well.
The sounds are so pleasing. It's almost, it puts me in mind a little bit almost of the way a children's poem might work, where the sounds are so pleasing that you don't realize there's something darker, a little darker.
Yeah, some of this stuff is talking about big, dark things like those enormous bushfires and the kind of scale of that it's really difficult to wrestle with. And I think it's almost impossible to do justice to it by talking simply about all of it at once. So using rhythm or sound helps you sort of, actually work your way through those ideas a little bit.
You do write children's poems, children's poetry?
Sometimes. Yeah, writing poems for kids I think is like writing for adults, but just perhaps having a little bit less in the poem, you know, in terms of complex language and perhaps less complex ideas. But I think that, you know, it's always the same thing. It's always about having language that engages and ideas that are interesting and perhaps something that either you know that you know but you haven't thought it through yet, or sort of a different perspective on the same, you know, on something quite common.
Maybe children's poetry is a little bit more distilled, or?
Yeah.
Natalie Cook reads her poem Gulp, which is on the Australian Children's Poetry website.
It's a poem that is very much from my childhood. It's about a what I call sleepy lizards. Sometimes here they're called shingleback lizards, which are lizards that actually love to eat strawberries. And so I just had this image of this, of, you know, sleepy lizards eating our, like stealing strawberries from our strawberry patch. Yeah. One of the things I always valued as a kid was not being spoon-fed things too much. So it's a poem that does just kind of put you in the middle of things straight away. It doesn't give you any context. It just launches in. Gulp. There's a lunge and a wriggle. He's caught it. Poor strawberry, mashed to a pulp by those omnivorous jaws. We watch joy beam in the lizard's eyes. Red juice stains his granite chin as the sweet taste of summer floods his tongue.
Natalie ends Wrestling with Bees with a section in which she works small, leaf litter, snapshots of the natural world. Some of the poems are quite funny, and again, birds appear.
You've got this wonderful way of working small, too.
Sometimes small ideas are, you know, they can hold a lot, you know, both just in observation for its own sake and in what you can take from that, whether it's, you know, thinking about things from a lizard's perspective or, you know, whatever it happens to be. You know, you can build a lot from really small things. We have on our neighbour's roof crested pigeons, which just carry on astoundingly, you know. And they are hilarious to watch. And so that led to two lines. Pigeons courting on the power line, a fan dance concealing nothing.
And actually, the one above it made me laugh out loud.
Oh, yeah, again, that is a walking poem. Spring morning walk, magpie patrol zones, interval training.
Just the idea of him having to get out of the way when it's spring.
Yeah.
Might swoop.
Yeah, you know where the magpie sort of, the bits with the magpies are and where you might just need to get a bit of a wriggle on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
And the proud dad bod.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my gosh. I howled when I got to that. and then I howled, then I paused. And then the fullness of the image then came to me again, and I laughed yet again.
That's good. Yeah. That one, I'd sort of been thinking about for a little while. Proud dad bod, the deep prow of a seahorse. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody says proud dad bod, nobody expects a seahorse.
Yeah.
And yet.
A super topical one for this week is just a three-line one. Coel's spiralling call winds up the neighbourhood. Because they've just arrived in our suburb again, so we can hear them sort of beginning their whistling. They sort of have this call through the night that just never quite stops. Yeah.
Natalie Cook's poetry bears many signs of her having been raised by a biologist father.
Yeah, just that experience of growing up always looking at things around us, not just thinking, isn't that pretty, but how does this relate to that? You know, what's going on here? The earth's churned up here, you know, is it a rabbit or echidna? You know, things like that, just sort of, that's how we grew up, just thinking about that stuff. And so it's stuff I still do and think about, you know, as I sort of walk around going, oh, what's that? Earth moving. Tumbling, churning, scuffling, roughing. Fumbling, turning, ruffling, scuffing. Underfoot, underneath, underground. Each evening, earth movers set to work, ferreting out fungi, unearthing ants. They piece a patchwork landscape where they reap what they sow. Crepuscular, muscular, preparing ground for seeds to settle, a traditional terrestrial turndown. Today, their edaphic activity is quantified, so it counts. Bioturbation, the best ideas take root in well-worked ground. Also active in the undergrowth, adjectives with appetites, adjectives with sharp-toothed smiles, feline, canine, vulpine.
What are you working on now?
Apparently my poems have a really long gestational period, I've discovered. But what I'm really interested in, there's a bit of it in Wrestling with Bees, is ekphrastic poetry. So poetry that responds to usually visual art, in my case. Particularly, I think I'd like to have a look. I've sort of made a start on some work on sort of 20th century Australian women artists, and I think that's where I want to really focus next. But it's still very much in its infancy, so it's going to take a while to work out sort of how to marry what I want to say with, again, with form and really sort of lock it down and tighten it.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, our visitor has been Natalie Cook. Come back next time for our discussion with visiting British poet Oz Hardwick. For ArtZone FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, December 4 at 7 p.m, Jeff's Poetry presents Ross Donlan and Harry Lang. Ross Donlan has published 5 poetry collections and several chapbooks, is collaborating with Jen Webb and Trish O'Hare, and has won 2 international poetry prizes. Based near Braidwood, Harry Lang is a poet, comic performer, and children's author. Time of Fire, his 4th collection from 2023, recounts his experience of the 2019-2020 fires, both as a landholder and member of the RFS. He also has 3 books of poetry for children. For 5 years, he emceed the Poetry Alive at Stanley Street Gallery poetry readings in Sydney, and together with poet Nicola Bowery, runs the Poetry Alive Poetry Weekends. On Monday, December 11, that poetry thing presents Eamon Wall from Ireland and the launch of Tim Metcalfe's Selected Poems, plus open mic. On December 18, that poetry thing says goodbye to 2023 by taking a look back on another year of poetry before breaking until January 22. The University of Canberra's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research has announced the winners of the 2023 Vice Chancellor's International Poetry Prize, which has been offered since 2014. First place of $15,000 went to Brisbane-based Damon O'Brien for Natural Causes. The second place prize of $5,000 went to Tasmania-based former Poet Laureate of Colorado, David Mason, for Moon on the Huon. First place for poet from an economically developing nation, also of $5,000, went to South African poet Jeannie Wallace McEwen for Climate Emergency. An anthology of poems of the listed and winning poems from the contest will appear in 2014. Applications are open for the Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award for Female Poets, hosted biennially by the University of Sydney. The Bell Award offers $40,000 to the author of a collection of poems between 50 and 80 pages. Entries close on Monday, December 18. Search online for University of Sydney Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award 2023. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monaghan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Remas frenas donis.